Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Professor of Politics, Stephen Zunes, who assesses the popular uprising in Egypt and the long history of U.S. support for anti-democratic, repressive regimes around the world. Terry Nelson, a retired U.S. Customs and Border Patrol agent, who discusses the cost of the drug war in terms of lives ruined and tax dollars expended while offering an alternative vision for reform. And Mark Brenner, director of Labor Notes magazine, who talks about the coordinated attacks targeting public employees' unions across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Frustrated, largely unemployed youth are rocking the Arab capitals of Cairo, Algiers, and Amman. Massive street demonstrations have put authoritarian Arab governments on notice that years of economic stagnation have reached a breaking point. The youth rebellion in Tunisia began in mid-December when 26-year-old street vendor Mohamed Bouzizi set himself on fire with gasoline after being harassed by police. This event sparked weeks of street protests by educated young people in their 20s and 30s who lacked decent jobs. The protests led to the overthrow of Tunisia's longtime president Ben Ali, which then spread to other nations in the region. According to Foreign Policy magazine, Arab youth, many with college degrees, face a 40% unemployment rate. Moreover, North Africa and the Middle East have the largest percentage of young people and the highest overall unemployment rate anywhere in the world. For years, Arab commentators have warned about the consequences of the so-called youth bulge entering the economy. But undemocratic Arab governments have failed to respond by developing enough jobs for educated young people, which in turn has led to humiliation, alienation, and anger now seen in the streets. The Guardian newspaper reports United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is pulling back from having a direct role in future climate change negotiations. Ban is refocusing his energy on the broader issues of sustainable development and promoting renewable sources of energy. The UN decision to downplay the prospect of a global carbon reduction treaty reflects growing doubt that international consensus can be found on climate change policy as the current Kyoto Protocol expires. Top aides to Secretary General Ban say he will have a limited role in the discussions leading up to the next summit of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in Durban, South Africa, this December. In the recent past, Ban has called global warming, quote, the greatest collective challenge we face as a human family. Next year, Ban will push ahead on sustainable development and focus on the 2012 summit in Brazil that will mark the 20th anniversary of the first Rio Earth Summit that set an ambitious global agenda on climate change and preserving biodiversity. In 2009, Ban staked his reputation on the critical climate summit in Copenhagen, but the strategy backfired as climate talks stalled and no new agreement emerged. Now the climate negotiators are working on a gradualist approach focused on creating green jobs and helping poor regions like Africa and South Asia adjust to rising temperatures. According to the news magazine In These Times, the percentage of workers in American unions has reached a new low, below the rate seen in 1936, before an explosion of industrial union organizing and sit-down strikes that gave birth to the United Auto Workers Union. 600,000 dues-paying union members were lost in 2010 alone. To survive difficult times, unions are reaching out to allies like environmentalists, immigrant rights activists, and religious leaders. Some hard-hit unions, like the UAW, have developed long-term plans to do mass organizing campaigns at foreign-owned auto plants. The recession triggered massive layoffs in the heavily unionized sectors of the economy, like construction and manufacturing. In contrast, heavily unionized Western European countries and Japan saw trade unions negotiate short-term work agreements that reduced work hours among the broader workforce that saved nearly 750,000 jobs. In one sign of renewed labor energy in the U.S., over 48,000 workers from the Transportation Security Administration, who provide security at airports, will vote in a union election in early March. They will choose to be represented by either the American Federation of Government Employees or the National Treasury Employees Union. This election comes nearly a decade after the TSA was created in the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
The people of Tunisia sparked popular revolts across the Middle East when they took to the streets to demand the ouster of their president. Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, who held power in Tunisia for 23 years, fled into exile with his family to Saudi Arabia after protests over economic issues gained momentum across the North African nation. Protests against other authoritarian governments soon spread to Yemen, Lebanon, and the Arab world's most populous nation, Egypt. Angry protests against U.S.-backed Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, who ruled his nation for 30 years, soon took center stage. Egyptians from all walks of life joined massive demonstrations in Cairo, Alexandria, Suez, and other cities and towns, demanding Mubarak's immediate removal from office. The U.S., which provides Mubarak's government $1.3 billion annually, was caught in a dilemma on how to react to the rebellion against its most important Middle East ally after Israel. In a major address delivered to the Muslim world from Cairo in June 2009, President Obama spoke eloquently of human rights and democracy. But apart from the rhetoric, and until the January uprising, he continued to follow the Bush administration's policy of supporting repressive governments across the Middle East. The unrelenting protests, met with open sympathy by the Egyptian army, pushed Mubarak to announce on February 1st that he would not seek re-election in a vote scheduled for September, but vowed to remain in power through the end of his term. The concession was rejected by many demonstrators. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Stephen Zunes, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, who assesses the popular uprising in Egypt and the long history of U.S. support for anti-democratic regimes around the world.
Well, in many ways, it's just a continuation of what we've seen in the past 20 or 30 years of these unarmed insurrections that have taken down autocratic regimes from the Philippines to Poland, you know, from Chile to Serbia, and even lesser-known countries like the Maldives and Mali. I mean, this is basically people who realize that they can't work for change within the system, that armed struggle has all sorts of problems associated with it, and so they're willing to go out into the streets and place their bodies before the tanks and the tear gas and truncheons and bullets to fight for their freedom. And there had been, you know, some uprisings like this in the Arab world that had been short-lived, but Tunisia, I think, really helped indicate that it was possible to overthrow a government by these largely nonviolent means. And just let me mention that while the rioters tend to get most of the attention from the media, in fact, well over 90% or more of the protests in both Tunisia and Egypt were nonviolent. But I think certainly the worsening economic situation, I mean, both Tunisia and Egypt had that bad combination of liberalizing economically while not liberalizing politically. And so the inequalities and social injustice just got exacerbated because of the influence of corrupt, well-connected families. The fact that you have the demographics where over half the population is under 30, and even people with college educations were unable to find jobs.
How do you assess the Obama administration's reaction? I mean, it seems to, I think, most everybody that they are equivocating, they're on the fence, they're trying to hedge their bets. And I'm sure that's apparent to people on the street in Egypt and other countries around the Middle East. What does that do to the U.S. reputation in terms of, what we all would like the world to think of us as international number one promoter of democracy?
Oh, it's been a great moral and political failure, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the very fact that we have, over the past 30 years, nearly 30 years of the Mubarak dictatorship, has sent that regime over $50 billion in military aid, is which had nothing to do with their legitimate defense needs. I mean, the tear gas, the bullets, the water cannons, the vehicles, I mean, the stuff that's been used by the police to suppress the pro-democracy demonstrators are all made in USA. And to talk about, oh, we had to invade Iraq to promote democracy, while, I mean, that was as big a lie as weapons of mass destruction. We've always been the number one supporter of dictators in that part of the world. And this really has had a negative impact on America's reputation. I always thought it strange that you have the United States give all this assistance to these repressive military-backed regimes that suppress democratic movements, and then we turn around and say, oh, there's no democracy in the Arab Muslim world because it's not in their culture. And then we also say, oh, we have to support Netanyahu because Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. I mean, if we weren't so busy supporting these repressive regimes, there'd be a lot more democracy. And I think what Tunisia and Egypt have demonstrated is that when democracy does come to the Middle East, it's not going to come through foreign intervention. It's not going to come through sanctimonious statements from Washington, but it's going to come through the Arab peoples themselves, from the grassroots, from the bottom up. And so I think the Obama administration belatedly has been coming around to a more responsible position, not because of a great moral shift, unfortunately, but simply because they recognize that it would be pretty stupid to be on the wrong side of history.
Stephen, there's a lot of speculation, of course, on what shape any new government might take in Egypt if, as expected, eventually Mubarak will fall. What's your take on what kind of government Egypt might have, given the opposition forces that are there now and have been repressed for these many years? A lot of discussion about Mohamed El-Baradei, the Nobel Peace Prize winner. What's your guess here as to how this may come out?
Well, the best case scenario, that it would be in pretty short order, an interim coalition government would be formed, made up of the liberal and democratic and moderate Islamist parties. They have already united to say that they are willing to serve together, and that Mohamed El-Baradei would indeed be the interim leader, and that this interim government would, as soon as practical, organize free and democratic elections so the people of Egypt themselves can decide what kind of government they want. My guess is that there would be some kind of coalition that would include moderate Islamists, but it's important to note that those who've really been leading the charge here in the streets have been these young secular group that, frankly, see the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, the traditional opposition, and their aging leadership as at least as out of touch with their day-to-day realities as the regime itself. And the fact that the Brotherhood refused to even endorse the demonstrations until after they got going and were receiving widespread support obviously smacks of opportunism, and it really hasn't helped their standing. So despite what you hear on Fox News or whatever about, Muslim fundamentalists are going to take over and that kind of thing, my strong sense is that it's not something we have to worry about, especially since the Brotherhood, though socially quite conservative, not a party that I would vote for if I was Egyptian. They've renounced violence. They've condemned terrorism. You know, they want to be a legitimate political actor in a democracy.
That was Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco and author of the book Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. Read his articles online at stephenzunis.org. In October 2009, the U.S. Border Patrol fired employee Brian Gonzalez just before his two-year probationary period was up. He was terminated for the personal opinions he expressed several months earlier to a fellow officer. Gonzalez told his coworker that the best way to reduce drug-related violence on the U.S.-Mexico border was by legalizing drugs. He also stated that as a Mexican-American, he understood why many Mexicans felt they had no choice but to try to enter the U.S. without documents in search of jobs. On January 20th of this year, the American Civil Liberties Union of New Mexico filed a lawsuit against the Border Patrol for firing Gonzalez on the basis of his personal beliefs expressed in a casual conversation rather than his job performance. Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, is supporting Gonzalez. The group is made up of 30,000, mostly retired, police, judges, prosecutors, and others who believe the drug war the U.S. has been waging for the past 40 years is an expensive failure, and that legalizing and taxing drugs would reduce violence. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Terry Nelson, a retired U.S. Customs and Border Patrol agent who spent 30 years fighting the drug war on the Mexican border throughout Central America and parts of South America. He discusses the cost of the drug war in terms of lives ruined and tax dollars expended while offering an alternative vision for reform.
For example, we spent a little over $7 billion on Plan Colombia to eradicate the cocoa crop. At the end of the program, the vice president of Colombia announced that cocoa production was up 27%. And instead of lowering the production, it actually raised it. We get about 16 to 17% of the narcotics that's being shipped to us. We interdict that much. The rest of it gets through. So let's say, for example, we got 50% of the narcotics that are coming through. All that would do is drive up the price on the remaining 50% and increase the violence because the trade routes would be more lucrative. So it's a hamster wheel. You get on it, you can't get off that way. So our lead position is that we need to change our total strategy from one of interdiction and prohibition of the narcotics to legalization, whereas you have a chance to regulate and control the distribution of manufacture and who can buy it, who can sell it, and you take the criminal cartels and drug gangs out of the matrix. Now, we acknowledge that this doesn't fix our drug problem. This fixes the crime and violence problem and the 30,000 lives that have been lost in Mexico in the last 3.5 years. We do away with most of the violence, not all of it, but, you know, probably 80% of the violence we'll do away with. Our drug problem is a social problem and a medical problem, best dealt with through education. And when you fall through the cracks, you become addicted, or you know, you start abusing certain drugs, and you need medical care to cure yourself of it. Putting a person in prison doesn't cure their addiction. It just postpones it till they get back out. Plus, it also puts him in contact with true criminals that are in there for violent reasons. So we think it's a hamster wheel, and the best way would be to legalize it, regulate and control it, educate and treat. And the places that's done it, i.e. Portugal, they just released a 10-year study where they decriminalized all drugs. They didn't legalize them because of the United Nations treaties that we have with the whole world. But they have half the drug use in Portugal that the surrounding countries in Europe do and what we have here in the United States. Ironically, the countries with the harshest penalties, Britain and America, have the highest drug use.
Terry Nelson, just about every state and the federal government are facing huge budget holes this year. Even if we didn't legalize and therefore tax drugs, just ending the mass incarceration of nonviolent drug offenders would save billions of dollars. Do you think the budget crisis will help your cause?
Well, we've always believed that there would be a watershed event that came along that really pushed our movement forward very rapidly, and the collapse of the economy is one of them. But we spend around $70 billion a year prosecuting the drug war, the $30,000 a year to keep a person in jail, the court costs, the police costs, the overtime costs, all this stuff. And Jeffrey Meriden, the Harvard professor, economics professor, guesstimated we could make probably $17 to $20 billion in tax revenue off of taxing it. But just the social savings alone would be phenomenal. Of course, I would recommend if you tax it using the revenue to treat those that fall through the cracks. Of course, you know how that would work. They'd probably take the revenue and put it in general fund and buy vehicles for the politicians to drive around in.
There's a debate in some circles, you know, between those who support decriminalization or medicalization, but not legalization. Why does LEAP support legalization, which I guess is the most extreme of these options?
Because decriminalization doesn't fix the core problem, which is the drug cartels and criminal street gangs that control the distribution. They're the violent ones, not the users. It's not just America that has this. This is a global problem. In America, we have a very low death rate compared to other parts of the world. We have like 9 per 100,000 here, and Jamaica has 38, 39 per 100,000. You know, we're very fortunate that it hasn't hit us. And remember, 30,000 people have been killed in Mexico in the last 3.5 years since Plan Medida went into effect. LEAP has members in 90 different countries in the world, by the way. So, you know, we have people on the streets telling us what's going on there. We understand the global effects of this drug war. And so, for example, even if we could manage to control the intake here in America to some extent, it would just push it up in other parts of the world. So you haven't fixed the problem. You put a Band-Aid on this area. And believe me, once they start tightening down over there, the bleeding effect will come into play, and the usage will come back here once you gear down a little bit. So you need to fix the problem.
That was Terry Nelson of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Contact the group by calling their Massachusetts office at area code 781-393-6985 or visit their website at leap.cc. With cities and states across the U.S. struggling with a bad economy, decreased tax revenue, and budget shortfalls, some governors and legislators are campaigning hard to reduce the compensation and power of public employees' unions. Governors in many states are demanding layoffs, cuts in state employee benefits, and wage freezes. But along with the predictable calls for austerity caused by severe budget crises, some conservative politicians and activists are seeking to cripple the power of labor by blocking the mandatory collection of union dues and denying state workers the right to organize unions and negotiate contracts. The campaign to turn public opinion against organized labor has included the charge that union members are overpaid and make more on average than private sector workers. However, a study recently conducted by the Economic Policy Institute found that state and local public employees earn about 11% less than their private sector counterparts. Behind the scenes, the American Legislative Exchange Council, comprised of corporate executives and Republican Party legislators, is promoting and disseminating templates for anti-union laws to state legislatures across the U.S. Many union activists charge that the drive targeting labor is motivated by partisan politics, with the goal of undermining unions' ability to contribute to mostly Democratic Party candidates. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mark Brenner, director of Labor Notes magazine, who assesses the current campaign against public employees' unions and the labor movement's response.
You know, we have to take stock of where we were 2 years and some change ago, when, you know, the entire country, hell, the entire world recognized that it was, you know, bankers and CEOs who for over three decades have been absolutely running roughshod over the rest of us and definitely operating without any effective oversight or regulation. You know, greed was good. That was the mantra. The market will solve all problems. You know, everybody recognized 2.5 years ago that strategy, that whole constellation of policies and sort of approach to economic policymaking drove the U.S. economy and practically the whole world economy off a cliff. And now, you know, a short 2 years later, we're in a situation where it's not the CEOs and the bankers who are responsible for this global economic meltdown. It's public school teachers and librarians. And it's really an Alice in Wonderland kind of world we're living in when you're blaming home care workers and ambulance drivers for these economic problems. And in my mind, I think it's really a, kind of a twofold bait and switch. I mean, on the one hand, you know, it's definitely the rich and the people who've been raking it in for 30 years trying to get it out of the limelight and really change the subject, you know, kind of turn the spotlight off of them and onto other people and pit worker against worker.
Mark, maybe you can tell us a bit about the efforts underway state to state. Some Republican governors who are supported by newly elected Republican legislatures are attempting to roll back unions' rights to organize, to strike, to have any kind of effective leverage at the bargaining table. Maybe you could specify some of what's going on out there.
Well, I think that there's a couple different flavors that we're talking about. For public sector workers, you're seeing things like in Ohio, where John Kasich, the new governor, is moving to limit the right to strike for teachers. In other states, they're trying to expand right to work laws. I think seven states now have some plan underway to implement right to work, which essentially bans private sector unions from entering into contracts that would require people that work at the company where the union represents the workers to either have to join the union or pay some portion of union dues for the servicing that they, you know, receive under the union contract, which is a major blow to union strength. And it's you know, led to nothing but lower wages and higher incidences of poverty in the South, which is where right to work really is kind of firmly entrenched. Another thing that's happening that I think is a really big blow is in areas where unionization has finally arrived in the public sector, people who are like home care workers or child care workers who really take care of some of the most vulnerable people in our society, their right to be in a union is being called into question. A lot of these folks were allowed to unionize by executive order, and now that Republicans are coming in certain states, they're trying to undo those orders. And even in states where, you know, we've got Democratic governors in California and New York, there's definitely the old-fashioned attack on unions, which is just through layoffs and essentially a political battle. So I think from the private sector to the public sector, particularly in the public sector right now, Republicans and some Democrats have it absolutely in their sights that they're coming after the labor movement.
Mark Brenner, what about public opinion here? It seems that the conservative and corporate interests that are working to undermine unions can really only get away with the full extent of what they're trying to do to weaken unions if public opinion is somewhat on their side. Tell us a little bit about where you think public opinion is right now and what the unions can do to fight back.
Well, I think that there's no question there's a 24-hour spin machine at work here trying to, paint a picture of public employees as overpaid, as in cush jobs, as raking in outsized pensions, as essentially, getting fat while the rest of America is suffering. And, of course, left out of this story is, A, the truth. Most public employees are hardworking. They make fairly modest salaries. They're paid about 11% less than their counterparts in the private sector. And unfortunately, from my mind, the labor movement has been far too afraid of taking our case to the public and actually defending loudly and proudly what public sector workers do. Look, we're the watchdog on corruption. We're the people who actually are defending the most vulnerable people in society. And so, what I think labor's job is really to try to get out there and do a lot more this sort of agitation around what government could and should be. And frankly, to find people who are willing to go out and run for office and try to put that into practice. It's not just that average citizens have a lower expectation of what government can do. Frankly, most politicians, Democrat and Republican alike, have really little to no imagination, little to no creativity, and really, really low expectations about what government could and should do.
That was Mark Brenner, Director of Labor Notes. Read his recent article, Public Sector, Public Good, online at the magazine's website, labornotes.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Todd. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.